Well, it's great the sun's come out. I want to sing "The Sun Has Got His Hat On," hip, 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 hooray. I can't sing very well. And thanks to those 60 people who went out at dawn, and I'm sure you're responsible for coaxing the sun over the horizon. I was asleep. So we've been here a couple of days, only a couple of days. It seems like much longer, doesn't it? In a good way, and sometimes it seems when it was really cold and wet, in not such a good way. And I think we're going quite deeply, we've already gone quite deeply into our theme of imagining the Buddha. So we've had some great talks, we've had lots of workshops, we've been chanting the mantra, we've had pujas, readings, plays, stories, meditations. And now we're exploring imagining the Buddha through ritual. So those people who were there began this morning at 4:45, I think it was. And now we're going to explore the southern realm. We're going to enter the southern quarter of the mandala, and that's the realm of the midday sun that shines equally on all. So I had to write this talk several weeks ago because we needed to get a text to our wonderful translators. And I had no idea what the weather was going to be like, of course. I mean, moment to moment, you don't know what the weather's going to be like, do you, in this country? So I've got two paragraphs, alternate paragraphs. One says, so here we are in an early June day, the sun rising to its zenith under a clear blue sky, warm, sunny day. And the other one says, which I thought was going to be the case yesterday, well, here we are, you know, in rain, cloud, etc. And you just have to imagine yourself under a clear blue sky, because we know, don't we, however thick the clouds, however cold it is, however heavy the rain, although it's really, really difficult, the blue sky is above us. The sun is always there. The blue sky is always there. If we go up high enough, we reach blue sky. And there's always blue sky mind underneath, behind the distractions of our mind, if we choose that blue sky mind. So anyway, today we're sort of half and half, aren't we? There is sunshine and there is blue sky. So I was going to then ask a question, which I'm going to ask. How does it feel to be under a blue sky in an early June day with the sun shining almost at its zenith? How does it feel? Well, I think to have any kind of sunshine, even a bit of blue sky after the rain of yesterday, we probably feel, don't we, more relaxed. So when the sun's out, we relax. We relax physically, we relax mentally, we relax emotionally. We feel more open, we feel freer, we can take off a layer of clothing. If we like, we can bask in the sun. So we're open, we're free, we're full of vitality, happiness, optimism. And these are all qualities of the southern realm of the Buddha. So the realm, the southern realm, is associated with the colour yellow, the colour of the midday sun. And it's also associated with the colour of gold. So I'm going to evoke that by reading you Sangharakshita's evocation of the symbolism of the colour yellow. So this is from his Creative Symbols of the Tantric Path to Enlightenment. And I think in this paragraph sums up, in a way, all the qualities of the southern realm. So yellow is the colour of sunshine. It's the colour of ripened grain, the grain of harvest, deep, rich and golden. It's therefore the colour of growth, of maturity, even of perfection. A good harvest means prosperity, so yellow is the colour of riches, abundance, profusion, plenty, not only in the limited material sense, but in the spiritual sense, in terms of spiritual riches. So yellow therefore suggests abundance of good qualities, and especially abundance of merits. So by extension, yellow also comes to signify whatever is rare, precious and valuable. And because what is precious gives delight, yellow also comes to have associations of delight, exuberance, and beauty of every kind, physical and spiritual. And at the very highest level, yellow comes to represent the inexhaustible wealth and incessant creativity of the awakened mind, a creativity that overflows in a shower of plenty on all living beings. So you get a very strong sense of abundance. And the Buddha of this southern realm, the realm of the midday sun, is associated with all those qualities, with growth, with potential, with abundance, with riches, with plenty, with exuberance, with beauty, and with this spontaneous, creative shower of plenty. So that spontaneous, creative shower of plenty is symbolized in the gesture or mudra of dana, that open-handed gesture, mudra, of the outward-facing hand of supreme giving, of open-handed generosity, unlimited generosity that gives to all without exception. And all that comes from the abundance of the Buddha's awakened mind, from his inner spiritual wealth, which is inexhaustible and limitless. So it's interesting that in Buddhism, in early Buddhism, there are two terms that we translate as generosity. The first one is dana, which we're very familiar with. But there's another term, kaga, C-A-G-A, kaga, which expresses the inner dimension of generosity, and it means a heart bent on giving. It's a lovely phrase, isn't it? A heart bent on giving. So this is the inner dimension of generosity, and dana is seen as the outer expression, the actual giving of gifts, as it were. So obviously one affects the other in a kind of feedback loop, doesn't it? If you just start to give, that will affect how you feel in your heart. And once you have that more open-hearted sense, you're going to give more spontaneously. So in Buddhist teaching, mind and its qualities are primary. Intention is primary. So generosity is not so much about the amount given, but about the quality of mind that gives. And kaga is this state of mind, the state of mind of the generous giver, the desire to give. So open-handed, this open-handed generosity implies open-hearted. So giving from this inner feeling of abundance, giving from a pure heart without any thought of return. And all this is symbolized by the Buddha of the south, of the southern region of the mandala. So interestingly, kaga, this heart bent on giving, also has connotations of renunciation, of letting go, of relinquishment. Terms and ideas sometimes we're a little less comfortable with, but it's obvious, isn't it? You can't give unless you let go. You can't hold on to everything and give at the same time. It's not possible. Yes, so we can't give unless we let go. And ultimately, what we're letting go of is all grasping and clinging to any sense of I or me or mine. And we can give in this way, and the Buddha gives in this way absolutely, because he sees the way things are. He sees that everything is without essence, without fixity. Everything is impermanent, ephemeral, evanescent, and insubstantial. So there's a wonderful verse in the Diamond Sutra, which is a Mahayana sutra, which says, like stars, a fault of vision or a lamp, a dewdrop, a moksha or a bubble, a dream, a lightning flash, a cloud, so should we view what is conditioned. So you can just take that verse and reflect upon it. So a dewdrop, a bubble, a dream, a lightning flash, a cloud, they're all there, aren't they? They're all there, they're all present, they have an effect, but they have no substance. They come and they go very quickly. Maybe clouds, not so much. So that just gives us a sense. If you reflect on that verse, we start to have a sense that phenomena cannot be grasped or held on to. Everything changes. Everything arises in dependence on conditions, things, people, and of course, ourself. This self that we think of as so fixed, so enduring, so separate, is an illusion. We are a stream of ever-changing phenomena, feelings, thoughts, mental events. So there's nothing to hold on to and no one to hold on to anything. Why would we hold on to anything? What would be the point if we had that kind of understanding? In fact, at that level, the level of the awakened mind, it's completely impossible to hold on to anything. Nothing can be owned, and we give without thinking of the giver, the gift, or the recipient. So then giving becomes an expression of our own inner nature. Nothing is given to anyone. We give appropriately, without self-consciousness, just like a flower blooming. Nothing is owned, and everything is given. So the ultimate renunciation, we're talking about renunciation in terms of this word kaga, is the renunciation of this false perception of a separate I. The essence of generosity is non-attachment. The non-attachment that arises just from seeing things as they are. And when we touch into that, we begin to experience the riches of our own creative minds as we become one with that flow of experience. So there's a traditional in Buddhism to recollect death, to reflect on death. And in that recollection, in that reflection, we reflect that we can't take our possessions, our friends and relatives, however kind or supportive, or our body with us when we die. We have to let everything go. So the purpose of that reflection, that recollection, is to encourage us to start to let go now, so that we begin to understand that we can't hold on to anything. So while I was thinking about abundance and letting go, I find that quite an interesting, it's a contrast or a paradox, even though they go together. You can't give unless you give from abundance, but you can't give unless you let go. I find that quite a fascinating contrast. So I was thinking about that, about open-heartedness and open-handedness, and I was also began to think about the opposite. So I got really fascinated by misers. I went off onto a whole track of exploring miserliness, and then I got interested in hoarding. I'm a declutterer, so I'm not a hoarder. But there was an article in a magazine recently about people who hoard, and people who hoard don't necessarily hoard things that are wonderful or beautiful. Some people hoard rubbish. It's just that they just cannot let go of things, and it's distressing for their friends and family, distressing for them. So yes, the whole idea of miserliness and hoarding kind of fascinated me, and I went off onto a whole sidetrack, which I can't tell you all about in great detail. I haven't got time. But I was just very interested in that, and I was interested that obviously the opposite of that open hand of generosity is the closed fist, isn't it? It's just quite interesting to think, well, how does that feel? So if you open your hand and you sit with your hand open, you can try it now, what's going on? You know, as you open your hand, how does that feel in your body? Do you feel a sort of relaxation in your heart, in your mind, in your body? And then you close that fist, what happens? Well, I can feel my whole arm tense and my shoulders tense and my jaw tense, and I'm frowning, probably all sorts of other things are tensing, and I can feel I'm more tense emotionally, more tense in my mind. So if you're doing that, you better let go. So you go back to that open-hearted relaxation. It's quite interesting, isn't it, the effect that that has on our whole psychophysical organism. So misers have got a very tight, closed fist, haven't they? And there's lots of misers in Western literature. Silas Marner comes to mind. Silas Marner, you know, just has his hoard of gold that he kept looking at. I mean, poor man, he'd had a hard time, and this was his, he did it, I think, in lieu of human affection. Scrooge, if you live in England, you get Scrooge every Christmas, you get lots of movies about Scrooge. And misers usually, in literature, they turn around, they lose their that kind of gripping onto things. There's also a famous tale, isn't there, in Greek mythology of King Midas. So this is quite interesting, because King Midas wants everything he touches to turn to gold. So there's quite a direct contrast with the Buddha of the Golden Realm and letting everything go and giving from abundance. You have a very strong contrast. So Midas, in a way, he symbolizes the tragedy of avarice and greed. So he wishes that everything he touches turns to gold, with disastrous results, of course. So he's already very, very rich. He owns more than anyone in the world at that time. And that his money is a source of his happiness. He's always counting his gold. He's obviously very attracted to gold. And gold actually is very, very beautiful. You see real gold. It's very, very beautiful. So you can kind of understand the attraction. But then he wants to hang on to it and have more than anyone else. And then he wants to have even more. So he loves gold more than anything, even more than his beloved daughter, who's, interestingly enough, called Marigold. So one day he's granted a wish, and he wishes that everything turns to gold. And he's warned that this might not turn out well. But anyway, he goes for it. And to begin with, it does work well. He touches the podium, turns to gold, touches the microphone, touches his table, chair, whatever. You know, and he's absolutely ecstatic. There's more and more gold in his environment. Then he tries to have breakfast. So, you know, the water turns to gold, the porridge, whatever, turns to gold. And he begins to get very, very frightened and anxious because he realises, oh dear. And then his daughter comes into the room and he hugs her for comfort, and she turns into a golden statue. So his joy, his ecstasy, turns very quickly into grief. Now, luckily, he's allowed to have the wish revoked. and everything goes back to normal. And this is, of course, a moral tale. So he ceases to be a miser. He shares his wealth with everyone, becomes generous and grateful to others and much loved. So I think one of the morals of this story is be careful what you wish for, isn't it? Be careful what you wish for. You might get it. You need to know what your motivation is for what you wish for. And this reminded me of a story of Bhante some years ago. So Sangharakshita was travelling, I think, from London to Brighton with a bunch of people. And they stopped at a tea shop. They stopped at the oldie English tea shoppy, where there was an oldie English wishing well. So everyone but Bhante put money in the wishing well and wished. We don't know what they wished for. And then they said to Bhante, well, what would you have wished for? Would you have wished for enlightenment? And he said, no, of course I wouldn't have wished for enlightenment. Enlightenment is guaranteed if you make the effort. Big teaching. I would have wished for £1 million and I would have known how to spend every penny. And you know that he would have spent it on Dharma projects. He'd have probably spent it on India, actually. So it's just a very lovely little story. So there are misers in Buddhist scriptures. So this kind of exploration of misers that I was doing turned up the play that the kids did yesterday. I found this play, which was, they did very beautifully. So this is another story of misers in Buddhism. It's quite a similar story. This is a story of Kosya. So Kosya is also, in his day, a multimillionaire. Incredibly mean, like the person in the play yesterday. He wouldn't give anything to anybody, not even to mendicants. And to give to mendicants was part of the culture of the time. If you had food and, you know, more food, you would give it. You would particularly give it to a wandering mendicant. And he was so mean, he practically starved his servants and family. So one day he sees someone eating a cake and he wants it for himself, but he doesn't want to use any of his resources really to make the cake. So he is really, really miserable, and he goes off in a big sulk, and his wife's saying, what's wrong with you? And he says, well, I want this cake, but, you know, I'll have to use resources to make it. And she says, oh, I'll make you a cake. I'll make one for the whole town. No, they don't need cake. And so on, you know, I'll make it just for the servants. No, they don't need cake. How about you and I? I'll just make a cake for you and I. You don't need cake. So she, long-suffering wife, says, I'll just make you a cake. So he has his cake, and in this story, he goes right up into a tower in the palace, very, very high up, into a locked room so that he can just eat his cake in secret. Now, suddenly, when I thought of this, I thought of chocolate. Chocolate came into my mind. So I think we all have tendencies to miserliness, so somewhere on the spectrum. I'll come back to that later. But I'm thinking, I live in a community with 11 other people. Some people nodding over there. And sometimes people give me chocolate. And I've got a choice, haven't I? I live at the very top of the house, actually. The top floor. I have a choice. I can keep my chocolate upstairs and I can kind of nibble it. Actually, I'm not like that. If I've got chocolate, I eat it all. That's the way I am. I'm a hate type. Or I can think, I know the people in this house. I know they always want chocolate, you know. I can just take it downstairs and give it to everybody. So sometimes I do one thing, sometimes I do the other. Yeah, so he's up in his locked room, nibbling his chocolate, his cake. And the Buddha is in the vicinity. And the Buddha apparently can enter a certain type of samadhi. When he comes out of that samadhi with his psychic powers, he knows if there's anyone in the area who's ripe for conversion, who's ripe for the Dharma. And on this occasion, who knows why, but he thinks Kosya has got potential. There you go. So he sends Moggallana, who's one of his chief disciples, who has also psychic powers, to go and sort it out. So King's right up in his tower. There's a window, a locked door window, and Moggallana levitates outside the window and walks up and down in the air. This is wonderful, isn't it? I'm not going to explain any of this. He's just got those psychic powers. And the king, he kind of knows why Moggallana's there. He knows he's there for alms. In an unusual kind of way. And he doesn't want to give him any. He doesn't want to. And Moggallana does more and more magic. I don't know what he does, I can't remember, but he does all sorts of things. And in the end, the king thinks, oh, he's just not going to go away, is he, till I give him a bit of cake. So I'll just try and give him a tiny, tiny crumb of cake. And as he tries to do that, the cake starts to expand and expand and expand. And he realizes in the end he's just got to give the whole thing to Moggallana. And then Moggallana gives him a discourse on generosity. And then the miser has a change of heart, and he and his wife and all his family and retainers and whatever go to the company of monks, the Buddha and the company of monks, and feed everybody. So it's a transformation. So yeah, meanness, as a translation of a Pali word, is a translation of macharya. So that's the desire to hoard up property so that others cannot share it. And it also involves that kind of secrecy of hiding one's wealth, which Kosya demonstrates. And in English, miserly comes from miserable. So to be a miser in that, in the sense we've described, is to be pretty wretched and unhappy, very painful state of mind. So you can see that it's the opposite, isn't it? The opposite end of a spectrum of the abundance of the awakened mind. And so there's Midas with his gold. So he's, you know, he's interested in gold, but he wants to hang on to it and fix it and have it and have more and more of it. And then the Buddha of the South, you know, is completely open and abundant, and there's that creative shower of plenty. So it's completely opposite tendency, isn't it? And I think when we hold on to things, we create a sense of isolation, we create a sense of separation between ourselves and others. And when we give, we dissolve the barriers between ourselves and others. Yeah, that's what happens, isn't it? So reflecting on the Buddha in the South, in the southern quarter of the mandala, we can begin to connect with and absorb his qualities based on the principle that which we contemplate, that which we become. So if we sit in the presence of the golden Buddha of the South, that Buddha of growth and potential, of abundance and riches and plenty, exuberance, beauty and generosity, we begin to feel more expansive. So we could just sit in the presence of the Buddha in our imagination, get in contact with that feeling of expansiveness, get in contact with our own inner riches, abundance and potential. So then we can begin to move beyond any sense of inner poverty. We can begin to move into a kind of wealth mentality, where we connect ever more deeply with our own inner riches, and then we'll naturally wish to share with the world. We'll have no thought of running out of resources. That's what hoarders and miders, why they do that, why they hoard and why they keep things to themselves, is they're worried, they're frightened that they're going to run out. That was said in the play last night, wasn't it, that if I give everything away, I'll have lost everything. So we feel that we won't run out of resources because we have a beginning of an understanding that our riches come from our connection with the awakened mind, and that flows ceaselessly, spontaneously and creatively. So that's one way of developing generosity, is just sit in the presence of the golden Buddha of abundance, just reflect on his qualities. But we also have to understand that we're all somewhere, aren't we, on that spectrum of miserliness. You know, some things we give away more easily than others, don't we? And that's just part of the way we are. We hold on to things. We hold on... Oh, it's getting really warm, isn't it? We hold on to ideas, possessions, people. It's just part of the way we are. So we're born, we're unenlightened. We're born with senses, with sense experience, and that means we experience contact, that means we experience feelings, sensations, vedanas, and some of those vedanas are pleasurable, and then we want to have those pleasant experiences again and again and again. So it's interesting, isn't it? Craving is a sort of reaching out. There is a kind of open-handedness to that, but as soon as we move into grasping, it's so easy, isn't it, to move from feeling to craving to grasping, then that hand starts to form the shape of the thing we want, and we hold on to, we want again and again, and our mind in a way starts to form that shape, doesn't it? So we start to go into that closed fist, as it were. And all that is just underpinned by our unenlightened delusion about the way things are, that we think and feel that there is an I separate from experience, that has, as it were, and owns experience, and we think there are objects of experience which are in some way permanent, and that we can have and own. So that's the situation we're in. We're unenlightened. So we need to train in generosity. Sangharaksha, interestingly, says in Wisdom Beyond Words that generosity is innate. So it's an innate capacity, but we need to nurture and train that capacity. He says it's a natural quality of our own minds, so we may need to train it. And he says, giving is innate. We are innately void, innately pure, innately generous. The practice of dana is natural. So it's a very positive take on the human situation, isn't it? We have that capacity within us, but we might need to allow it to develop. We might need to practice. And there's a lovely story in a book by Dilgo Khyentse Rinpoche, a book called Enlightened Courage. And Dilgo Khyentse Rinpoche is one of Sangharakshita's teachers. So this is Dilgo Khyentse Rinpoche's commentary on the seven-point mind training. And this story comes under the practice called the power of familiarization. So the power of familiarization focuses on the principle that practice makes perfect. So Shanti Davis says, there's nothing that remains difficult if it is practiced. Again, very, very positive. Something might be very, very hard at the beginning, but you just step-by-step practice and it gets easier. So the story that Dilgo Khyentse Rinpoche uses to illustrate this, I can't find a textual reference for it, so it may just be a folk story. Anyway, it goes like this. Once upon a time, there was a very miserly person, unable to give anything away, and he went to see the Buddha. He said, it's impossible for me to be generous. What shall I do? So he knows he needs to be generous, but he's just finding it not just difficult, but impossible at this point. And the Buddha says, imagine that your right hand is yourself and your left hand a poor, unhappy person. Give from your right hand to your left hand some old food which you don't like or need. So this is just in your imagination. You're just trying to think, oh, rotten old food. I'll give it from there to there. This is me. This is someone else. Do it until you are no longer miserly. So the man began to practice, but he was so tight-fisted that at first he could give away only a few leftovers of food that he did not like. So gradually, however, he acquired the habit so that the day arrived when he did not feel so niggardly. So thereupon he went to see the Buddha and reported, now when I give food from my right hand to my left hand, I don't feel so miserly. So the practice is working. Just this practice and imagination, you know, from one hand to another. Buddha's amazing compassion and insight and wisdom, isn't it, into the nature of this person and what he needed. So the Buddha replied, now with your right hand, which you take to be yourself, give some gold, silk or fine clothes to your left hand, which you imagine to be a beggar. Try to see if you can give open-handedly without avarice. So the man tried, and when he got used to it, he went again to see the Buddha. Now you can be a benefactor, the Buddha said. You are free from attachment. You can give away food and clothing to those who lack them. So freed from his miserliness, the man thus came to help many beggars and poor people. He gradually practiced, and in the end, his generosity was steady, without any wavering. He understood that there was no point in being parsimonious and attached to riches. He became a monk and attained the level of an arahant. Through persistent practice, one may likewise become accomplished. So, very lovely story. So we have to begin somewhere. And the thing is, we can begin, can't we? Generosity is something that anyone and everyone, all of us, can practice. We can start from where we are and we can start to practice. We may not be able to meditate very deeply. We may not be able to be very concentrated in meditation, but we can always give. We can give materially, if you haven't got much materially. We can give our time, our attention, our energy, our kindness. We can listen to people. We can help people. And the thing is that all this works immediately against self-centeredness. As soon as we start to give, we open our heart, we become less selfish, less self-absorbed, less self-centered. So it's interesting that generosity was often taught first by the Buddha. So he might teach about generosity and then ethics, meditation and wisdom. It's the first perfection. It's the first means of unification of a community. It's the first duty of friendship because generosity connects and dissolves the barriers. But it's important not to think of giving, generosity, as just a preliminary. I think it's a whole path in itself. It's the whole of our spiritual practice, since to overcome self-centeredness is the whole purpose of the Dharma. So if you give, you overcome self-centeredness. So you just keep on giving, you make it a life practice. And at the end of the path, as it were, with wisdom, when generosity is imbued with wisdom, with an understanding of the way things are, then that becomes the perfection of generosity, and that becomes spontaneous without any thought of self or gift or other. So starting to give, it does begin to reverse that tendency to self-interest, that usual thought, isn't it? Even if it's very subtle, what's in it for me? That's often there, isn't it? It begins to thaw that sense of fixed self. And yeah, we become not just open-handed, but open-hearted. Our heart and mind become gentle. That fist begins to unclench. We begin to weaken attachments. And we start to feel kind of relief, a kind of joy. We start to feel lighter, softened, and that enables us to meditate more easily, because we're kind of, our heart is open, our heart is softer, and that open, softer heart is able to absorb any insights that we have. And that all comes out of just beginning to give, beginning to be generous. So we start to realize we've got wonderful qualities within. We start to tap into our own innate generosity, our own inner riches. And all that brings us more like and closer to the Buddha of the southern realm. We start to feel like we've got a jewel sewn in our coat that we didn't know existed. So translators, I'm about to jump a page. So yes, one of the things that cropped up in my mind when I was thinking about giving and giving from abundance, which I think is a very important way of approaching generosity, was this phrase, giving until it hurts. And I thought, where does that come from, giving until it hurts? It doesn't sound very dharmic or very Buddhist, does it? And Google, wonderful, Google, that phrase. Mother Teresa. So I think the full quote is something like, the true expression of love is giving until it hurts. Now, maybe what she meant was, if you give, you know, you're going to overcome self, you're going to go beyond your comfort zone, I don't know. And I thought, well, perhaps from a dharmic point of view, when we first start to give, when we first start to unclench that fist, well, it might hurt, mightn't it? Because, you know, the joints are tense, the muscles are tense, they've been like that for a long time. So to unfurl it, I've got a bit of arthritis as well, it's more difficult. To unfurl it, it might be painful to begin with. But the more we do it, the more enjoyable it becomes. I think that's the sort of Buddhist dharmic perspective on anything, really. The more you do it, in any skillful action, it becomes more and more enjoyable, more and more creative. So we're exploring the Buddha in the southern realm and the qualities which he manifests. And we can put ourselves in touch with those qualities by meditating and contemplating him. And I am quite fascinated by this contrast between abundance and having everything and relinquishment and having nothing. And I think that's expressed in the Buddhanusmriti, in the recollection of the Buddha practice that we do. So there's a recollection of the Buddha practice which involves meditating on, reflecting on qualities of the Buddha that are expressed in the Buddha Vandana, which is part of the Tiratna Vandana. So you just take a quality of the Buddha and you let that quality sit in your mind and see what kind of associations come up. So in this text, the text says, the Buddha, he is like this. He is Bhagavan. So that's the first quality. In this text, the Buddha Vandana appears again and again and again in the Pali Canon. It's very, very common as a way of reflecting on the Buddha and bringing the Buddha to mind. So he is like this. He is Bhagavan. He's the Blessed One. And it's often translated as richly endowed. He's the richly endowed one. He's the sublime one, the exalted one. So Bhaga means luck, good fortune, wealth, prosperity. It also means blessed. So he's richly endowed. He's endowed with radiant and positive qualities, human and spiritual. He stands out from everyone else. So when I do this practice and I think, he is like this, he is Bhagavan, if I'm in touch with myself, he's a richly endowed one, I have a very strong feeling of expansion, of unlimited riches and potential. I can sometimes feel a vast magical presence, really, really enormous, that's kind of golden and bejeweled, which every imaginable spiritual and human quality reflected in that as a facet. So he expresses all the qualities, all the different qualities of wisdom. They're all there. So understanding, clarity, perspective, vision, seeing things the way they are. All the different nuances of the qualities of wisdom, of compassion are there. A spontaneous response, sensitivity, empathy, kindness, solidarity. All the different facets of energy, persistence, determination, and so on and so on. So every quality of the Buddha is there, all the nuances, all reflected. So you have this vast sense of unlimited riches and potential. And it's interesting that in the Pali Canon, we think of the Buddha probably as, he's a wandering mendicant, isn't he, in patched robes, bald head, with nothing except his robe and his bowl. But some people saw the golden aspect of the Buddha. They saw the kind of inner abundance, as it were, when they saw him. So there's a story about a Brahma called Sela. And he goes to see the Buddha and he says, "O Buddha, you have a perfect body. You are resplendent, well-born, handsome, of golden colour. You have bright eyes, a handsome countenance. You are great, straight, majestic. You shine like the sun in the midst of the assembly of monks. You are of lovely appearance. You have skin like gold." So he doesn't just see the mendicant Buddha. He sees something else. He sees the inner dimension of the Buddha's mind. And another story in the commentaries recounts the Buddha's first meeting with one of his great disciples, Mahakasapa. So the Buddha apparently knows that Mahakasapa is on his way to meet him, and the Buddha sits down to wait for him. And it says, he did not sit there like an ordinary ascetic, but displayed all the sublime glory of a Buddha. He emitted rays of light so that the entire thicket became a blaze of light. When Mahakasapa saw the Buddha sitting there in full splendor, he thought, "This must be my master for whose sake I have gone forth." And he approached the Buddha and fell at his feet and exclaimed, "The Blessed One, Lord, is my teacher, and I am his disciple." So even the Buddha of the Pali Canon, the wandering mendicant with the patched robe, to some people appears, the inner state of his mind, awakened mind, appears to them. And perhaps it's this quality of the Buddha's golden radiance, Shakyamuni's golden radiance, his being richly endowed, Bhagavan, that later is developed into Ratnasambhava, the Buddha of the South, the Jinnah of the South, jewel-born and golden in colour, filled with good qualities, ready to bestow those qualities on all who ask. But then if you go on recollecting the Buddha in the Buddha Vandana, the next epithet or description we come to is Arahang. So he is like this, the Buddha, he is like this. He is Arahang, he's an Arahant. So that means that he's worthy of worship, worthy of offerings, worthy of respect. But in popular etymology, it also comes from a root, arahati, which means he has destroyed greed, hatred, and delusion. Or arihanti, the destroyer of the enemy. And sometimes that's translated popularly as he's the foe destroyer. So the Buddha is the foe destroyer. He's destroyed all the kleshas, all the poisons. He's pure of everything, all complications. He's completely and utterly free. So as I move from one term to the next, I think the Buddha is like this, he's Arahang. For me, he then appears much more like the Buddha of the Pali Canon. I kind of see him more at the corner of my eye, and he's a mendicant monk, very simple. In a way, he has nothing. So it's interesting that the Buddha and the Arahants were often described as akinchana, the man of naught. So that means having nothing of the ordinary world, having no pride, no regard to reputation, immune to scorn, cannot be classified or labelled. So Sangharakshita says of this term, he's called akinchana, man of naught, not merely because he is civilly a pauper, but because in the deeper psychological and metaphysical sense of the term, he does not regard any phenomena, however exalted, as his own, but abides free from grasping and without pain. So nothing belongs to us. That can only be realized by insight into the insubstantiality of things. Because things are impermanent, they can be taken away. What can be taken away? is not ours. So understanding that, we begin to let go of things. So I hope we're developing a sense of some of the qualities of the Buddha as manifested in the Southern Realm. He's both the man of naught, owning nothing, and the man who has everything to give, which he gives spontaneously from the abundance and creativity of his awakened mind. So the Buddha, of course, had nothing material to give. He just had his bowl and his robe. But in a way, his whole life, isn't it, was an expression of giving. He gave especially to us the gift of the truth, the gift of the Dharma. He gave us all the practices that make up the path so that we can follow the path to realise that truth. He gave occasion after occasion his time and attention, his wisdom, his understanding, his kindness and his empathy. He gave fearlessness and confidence. So let's sit in the presence of the Buddha of the Southern Realm, in his realm of beauty and abundance, where all wishes are granted, and where we begin to understand that the greatest wish is the desire to help all living beings. Let's bask in his golden light, the golden light of all his qualities, the golden light that pours down in abundance from his awakened mind onto all beings. Let's allow that golden light to penetrate every fibre of our being so that we bask in its warmth and are receptive to it like flowers opening to the sun. Let the presence of the Buddha of the Southern Realm and his abundant golden light engender in us a heart bent on giving.